examining, see, three categories. John, the individual. Then what's called an individualized form, this flesh and bones, this particular man. That would be the first, and look straight up, that would be the first level of abstraction. There's John out there, he's a thing, and you are able to abstract from John a form that you can put in your mind, since you can't get the individual John physically in your mind. You've got to get a form of John in your mind, so that's this flesh and bones, this particular man. Then you also have the ability to go another level of abstraction and get a universalized form, flesh and bones, namely man in general. So here's the literal man, John, standing out there. The first level of abstraction is a form in your mind, an image, a concept of him. Close your eyes, and what do you see? That individual in your mind is the first level of abstraction. Then abstract from that individual manness, humanness. And you've reached the final level of abstraction, which is called the universalized form. Now go up one step in the chart. There's the thing out there, the object. And then you see the brackets. There's perception and phantasm. The perception is the image received, and the phantasm is the image expressed. One is called the impressed species. That's the image received by perception. The other is called the expressed species. That's called a phantasm, having nothing to do with fantastic or phantasmagoric or anything like that. It's just medieval terminology, comes from the Latin. So that's the first level of abstraction. All of this is done by the agent intellect, the power of the mind to abstract things from sensible things. Now the agent intellect abstracts that, and then on the next level, on the intellectual order, you have the intelligible species, not just the sensible species, the perception and phantasm, but you have the impressed species in the mind. Now the first level there is the idea or mental word as received. That's called apprehension. The second level, judgment, is the idea as expressed in a proposition. That's called the expressed species. And there are two aspects in your mind there. There's the passive or possible intellect where you store these things, and there's the active intellect that actively does this, that actively abstracts them from the data it gets from the senses. So you have three levels, the thing, external thing, the sensible order, and the intellectual order. In the sensible order, you have two steps, perception, impressed species, phantasm, expressed species. In the intellectual order, you have two steps, impressed species, idea or mental word, as received, and expressed idea, as expressed in a proposition. So the sensible order is in the senses, the intellectual order is in the understanding. In the sensible order, it's received without matter, but not without the concrete conditions of matter, restricted to the here and now. In the intellectual order, final level, it's received without matter and without the concrete conditions of matter, not restricted to here and now, meaning you could think of man, not just John, who is here and now, but you could abstract from John humanness, which wouldn't touch any here and now. So the ability of the mind, the agent intellect, is the efficient cause of knowing. The phantasm is the instrumental cause of knowing. Of course, God is the primary cause of the agent intellect, and the agent intellect is only the secondary efficient cause of knowing. Now, if you have from that chart these basics, three order, the external individual, the internal individualized form of John, and then the broader universalized form that is of any human being, that's the basic. And then all you have to do from there is to go in the two steps inside of the sensible order, the received and the expressed, and the two steps inside the intellectual order, the received and the expressed. And what you're getting is a more abstract, more spiritual, if you will, more immaterial, more universal form, the higher you go, the farther you go across the chart from left to right, or the farther you go from the external version John to the predications about him. And the highest order is where you take this abstract image from John, abstract the image humanness from that, and then make some statement about humans. Humans are rational animals. Then you've reached the highest level which is a predication, a truth statement that corresponds to reality, which you learned through your senses about John, from which you abstracted about humans and made this affirmation that humans are rational. That's it in a nutshell, the chart, which is probably where it ought to be, in a nutshell somewhere. Any question about it? No. Is the procedure, well, let me broaden your question. How would you categorize the procedure by which we know according to Aquinas? Inductive, deductive, et cetera. Good question. I've just explained this. You think about it. Is this inductive? Is this deductive? Is it seductive? What is it?
Reductive.
Reductive. Abductive. Transductive. What is it? Let's take a given act of knowledge. The statement that man is a rational animal, which Aquinas thinks is a definition of man after Aristotle, that you get from your senses and by abstracting the essence of man, you can make this statement about man. How does he come to that? What are the methodological steps by which he comes to that judgment which he thinks corresponds to reality? Man is a rational animal. Yes, that's what he does. But what sort of label would you give? Is that an inductive process? Is that deductive? Is it? Okay, when you do that, what is that normally called? That's normally called inductive. But it's not a pure induction by any means. That's normally called inductive when you look at 100 penguins and they're all black and white, and from this induction you make the statement all penguins are black and white. So there's an important difference between that kind of induction and what Aquinas is doing that you must see. You're looking at a limited number of penguins there, and you're making a statement about their color, which is an accident. Color is an accident, not part of an essence of something. What Aquinas is doing is not getting just at accidental characteristics, but at the essence. And two, it's not simply an induction where you're making a probable statement. You're getting at the very essence of something, able to see and know it. So basically, this may surprise you, basically his epistemology is a form of intuitivism. It's a form of existentialism and intuitivism. It's existential because you are becoming the other as you know them. It's intuitive because you are seeing the essence through some abstract stages. Just as, take again a piece of paper with writing on it. You look at all the letters. Do you see letters when you read? What are you seeing? Are you doing an induction? Let's take the first line on this page. To know is to have been intentionally, that is, a representation of it. Now let's take another line. That'll be too hard. Let's just take a simple line, the tree is green. Now when you read that, what are you seeing? Are you doing an induction of the letters? The, T-H-E, tree, T-R-E-E, is, I-S, green, G-R-E-E-N, period. There's a sense in which you have to do an induction, right? You have to see all those particulars. If you don't see all those particulars, you're not going to get the meaning of that sentence, are you? But then, once you see all those particulars, you get a abduction. You get a gestalt. You see the whole thing. Or you don't. You'll never get the meaning if you can just see letters. That's what some people can't learn to read. For that. They're seeing letters or they're seeing them in reverse order. What's that disease called? Yes. They're seeing dyslexic. They're seeing in reverse order. What's their problem? They're never going to get the meaning of it as long as they're seeing them in reverse order, because the culturally accepted meaning of that isn't the other way. So you're going to have problems. So, yes, induction, but only in the sense that you're doing an induction of those letters to get the meaning the tree is green. Sooner or later, you're going to have to see the whole essence of that statement through the particulars. Now, call that what you want. It's a form of intuitivism. It's a form of existentialism. It has an inductive first step, to be sure. But it goes way beyond that in that it reaches out and gets the very essence of the meaning of the thing through the particulars that the senses are bringing to it. Now that's different. Now we're just talking about the first step now, the first act of the intellect and second act of the intellect, apprehend and judge. Now when you, in the second, we're talking about the first act there, then when we make a judgment, we are saying the man is, that's an existential is for him, the man is a rational animal, not simply a logical connective. Then he's making a judgment. Then he is making an existential intuition, not just a cognitive intuition. He is intuiting the relationship of that subject and that predicate to each other in reality, and that too is an intuition. Just take a statement like, I exist. How are you able to connect those two words, I and exist? I mean, you know you exist, right? How do you know you exist? The answer is you intuit the connection between I and exist. Nobody has to tell you. You don't learn. There's no syllogistic process. There's no inductive study. You intuit. Take another statement. Something exists. In this case, it may be external to you. How do you know that? You intuit the connection. The judgment is built on an existential intuition. Not intuition in the sense of a woman's intuition, or in the sense of intuition in a good guess type of thing, but intuition in the sense of holistic perception of the causal connection between, or if not causal connection, at least relationship between the predicate and the subject. So yes, he's an intuitivist, but he's a judgmentalist in that he's making an existential judgment. The man does exist. Reality does exist. I am real. And the connection between the subject and the predicate is seen or perceived in an intellectual intuition.
Going back here, when you say, I do exist, or I exist, you are. I don't intuit what it means to exist, don't you? I mean, I've been kind of told, or I've learned the meaning of that word. That's why I'm able to say that.
Let's connect the answer to this question is to the first principles we study. All knowledge is built on first principles. There are logical first principles, A is A. There are also ontological first principles, being is being. Something exists. You do intuit that something exists. Now, when you start to reflect about that, you know something about what it is that exists. How do you know that? You know it by first principles. By the principle of causality, teleology, identity, excluded middle, and using first principles along with your basic intuition that something is, and for that matter, you can look at the something and you can see it's changing. You say, not only something exists, but something is really changing. But if it's changing, it's coming to be. Whatever comes to be comes by a cause. You can look at it and say, it's changing, it must be finite. It could be or could not be. What you're doing is unpacking that existential intuition of being and getting some knowledge about it. So it's a long answer. The long answer is yes. You do intuit its whatness as well as its isness. But its whatness is implied in its isness when you're first intuiting it and then is unpacked by the use of first principles and further reflection on what it is you're intuiting. And you come to the conclusion it's contingent, changing, limited, finite, and then you unpack that and say, well, then there must be an infinite, unchanging, non-contingent being. Now you have a basic theism that you've unpacked from your basic intuition. So So in one sense, the rest of the course is an answer to that question. Namely, how does Aquinas take these basic intuitions of being and unpack theism from it? Anything else on the basic schema? Okay, the next thing is the relation of intellect and will in Aquinas. The act of the intellect is apprehension. Now, while you're apprehending something in your intellect, there's a corresponding act in the will called volition. And by intellect, we mean the power to think, and by will, we mean the power to choose. These are just different powers that a rational animal, man, has. So apprehension is an act of the intellect, but corresponding to that is volition, an act of the will. Then another act of the intellect is attainability. You not only apprehend, let's say, there's some food. You apprehend food. And you take a look at it and see if there's a big fence between you and the food, or a big wall, or a big window. And you say, is it attainable? Now, the corresponding act in the will to attainability is intention. You say, I want that food. That's a will. Intention is an act of the will, volition and intention, where apprehension and attainability are acts of the intellect. And another thing you do in your intellect, you deliberate about it. You say, how am I going to get across that fence to get that food? That's an act of intellect. Meanwhile, back at the volitional ranch, over in the will, your will consents, I will go for it. Then you make your will consents to that deliberation process, and then you make a judgment. The judgment is an act of the intellect. You judge the food is attainable. I can get over that fence. I will go over the fence. Corresponding to that is an act of choice. Your will corresponds by choosing what your intellect judges. Important footnote. The will is free to choose contrary to what the mind judges. Whereas in the other acts, they follow logically. Apprehension in the intellect, volition, act of the will, those are correlative acts. Attainability, intention, deliberation, consent. But when you get to judgment and your mind judges, that is something worthy to go after. And you make the judgment in your mind that is worthy to go after, still your will has to decide whether you are going to go after it or not. If judgment coerced the act of the will, then you wouldn't be free. See, this is Plato's fallacy. To know the good is to do the good. That's the whole premise behind Republic of Plato. If you teach people what is right, they will automatically do what is right. You've got to be an idealist. You've got to live in the world of forms to believe that. The real world ain't that way. But Aquinas says, no, you can judge something to be right and decide not to do it. You can judge something to be good, to be fulfilling, and decide not to do it. The will is always free not to choose even what the intellect judges it ought to choose, or is right, or is good. Then another act of the intellect is command. And the corresponding act of the will is use. Another act of the intellect is attainment. And when you attain it, that is, you get the food, you made it over the fence, you get the food, corresponding act of the will is enjoyment. The will is resting in and enjoying what it chose to use to fulfill what it apprehended or intended, rather, to go after. So let's take these one by one. Apprehension, the intellectual awareness of the object as good. Attainability, the apprehension of the object as attainable through possible means. Deliberation, the power of the intellect to discern among means. Judgment, the intellectual act of affirmation or denial. Command, the conscious ordering or relating of the will in use of means to end. Attainment, apprehension of the end as possessed. Volition, a tending to an end. Intention, a tending to an end as obtainable through a possible means. Consent, accepting of a thing as a means. Choice, the election of a means to an end. That's the point of morality there, the point of freedom.
use, the execution of a means to an end. I'll use this ladder to get over the fence, say. Enjoyment, resting in the end as attained, not a cessation, but a perfection of activity. And by the way, there is a kind of beatitude of heaven. The beatific vision will be just a big form of what you feel when you get over the fence and get the prime rib and start eating it, or whatever you like, McDonald's or what have you. But that'll be a kind of partial beatitude, a resting in, enjoying, but it's an active, not cessation, but perfection of activity. Then the end, that which is desired for its own sake, and a means, that through which an end is desired. Note, an end in intention is a cause, a final cause. An end in execution is an effect of the thing that you're going after. So there's a corresponding act of the intellect and an act of the will. The most important thing about this distinction of Aquinas is the difference between judgment and choice. After you apprehend it as attainable and deliberate and make a judgment, the intellectual act of affirming or denying, you are still free either to choose or not to choose to do what your intellect judges you ought to do. They're just corresponding but not coercing acts of intellect and will.
Especially
about judgment and choice, is this non-correspondence
something unique to man only and not shared by animals?
Yes. It's unique to man and angels. It's not shared by those below man, but it is shared by some above man.
What do you mean when we say an animal can make his choice?
Once an animal judges, say a hungry dog, that he can get over that fence and get that bone, once he judges that, he no longer has a freedom of choice about whether he's going to jump over the fence and get it.
What if some animals who overcome just for pleasure and not for meat?
But once they make that judgment, I want this for pleasure, then they're not free. If they were free with respect to those kinds of judgments, they would be morally culpable beings. And we should prosecute those kinds of dogs. When they go after, we really should send them to court. Because they apprehended, they deliberated, they made a judgment about it, and they had choice to do or not to do it, and they did it.
I gotta go ahead and ask, did the animals have souls?
Well, at least you aren't asking what I was asked almost every Bible. I had a lay Bible study for about 10 years in my home where we had people right off the street. Almost every meeting at the end, I'd be asked, will dogs be in heaven? So at least you spared me of that one and only asked, do they have souls? The answer is yes, animals have souls. The same word nephesh is used of animals in Genesis and elsewhere in the Old Testament is used of human beings. In fact, animals have spirits, too. According to Ecclesiastes, the word spirit is used at least once or twice of animals. The biblical usage of those terms does not fit the trichotomous theory. I'm a trichotomist, but not on the basis of the biblical usage of those terms, because it doesn't prove the point. All right, let's move on to the next point, which is... some special problems in Thomistic epistemology. Problem one, sense data and the data of senses. And the crucial passage here is Summa Theologica 178:4, add 4. That means answer to objection 4. And here, I simply want to point out what we already did, is that Aquinas does not believe that you are knowing sense data. He does not believe that
you are limited to sense data just because your knowledge comes through sense data, any more than you're limited to the alphabet and punctuation points just because everything you know from a given page comes by that means. There is more in the data of senses than sense data. There's intellectual stuff. Let me try another illustration. Take a code that you don't understand. You know it's a code because it has the linguistic patterns. They can tell the difference between, let's say, a message from ET and the static given off by a star. That's why they have the telescopes, the radio telescopes there at Harvard in the Caribbean, listening. And you can tell, you know, the same old redundant stuff from a star coming off. But if you heard, even if you didn't understand ET, it was a strange language, you could tell immediately that it was an intelligent being by the patterns and the sequences of letters and words. You can tell a language even if you can't read it. Look at the Rosetta Stone. Even if you can't read those languages on the Rosetta Stone, you know that it's not chicken scratching. You can tell the difference intuitively because of the sequence hypothesis. This work has been done by Shannon at Bell Laboratories, did the work on what's called information theory. And information theory has been applied to, say, the DNA, and they find that the DNA, which only has four letters in its alphabet, has the same sequence as a series of letters used in English, German, or anything. Okay, the best article is Information Theory by Herbert Yockey, Journal of Theoretical Biology, 1981. And they've shown that this information theory in language and the information theory in a DNA is identical just by sequence, even if you can't read the message. And Carl Sagan, you know, if it took these guys 100 years to decipher this message from ET, they'd still know it was a message even before they can decipher it. So now let's you and I put on the earphones and listen to the radio telescope, and we get this message coming through. We don't know what it is, but boy, it's a message. It's like, you know, Morse code. You listen to Morse code, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, something out there, it's not a woodpecker. I mean, a woodpecker, buck-buck-buck-buck-buck-buck, or whatever a woodpecker does, you know, you get this thing, but you don't get da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, that type of thing. All we're getting is sense data, but there's more in that than sense data. There's a message in it. There's a high-level intellectual communication from outer space, say, what have you. That's the difference between Aquinas and a pure empiricist. A pure empiricism is impossible, because if all you are getting is sense data, you'd never be able to understand anything through it. Pure empiricism, if you were really a tabula rasa, a blank slate, and had no powers or capacities above that, you get all this data, not only would you not be able to coordinate it, the common sense, forget about that, you wouldn't be able to make any judgments about it, you wouldn't get any meaning out of it. All you'd be hearing is sound, or see symbols, but get no meaning. So I don't know why this point is labored so much by empiricists. It seems so obviously true that Aquinas is not making a profound discovery here. He's just making a commonsensical affirmation.
Extra data that we have in the system, could we say that that really resides in the mind and its ability to coordinate and so on?
You can't say that alone. That meaning is in the page. Like you open the Bible and you look at a page. That meaning is not simply in my mind, and I'm not superimposing that on a text. Somehow that meaning is expressed in those words. And just like beauty is in the painting, so meaning is in the text. So there's more in that text than symbols. There's actually meaning on that page. In some mysterious epistemological way, that page contains objective meaning. My mind is able somehow to, I use the phrase liberally, decode that and adduce or induce or whatever you do to intuit and see that gestalt, you're able to get it out of that. But what you're doing is using a power that is above the senses, the mind, in order to see what still is objectively there that is more than senses, namely meaning.
Does the impressions in the mind, do they affect the way you
see? Impressions in your mind?
Become your object. papers and more studies, does that more compress your mind, and more does that affect your ability, how you see things?
I think it does. I don't think there's any question about the fact that when you read the Bible through once and then approach the doctrine of the Trinity, you see certain things about it and you see it correctly, let's say. But you can read the Bible through again and approach the same doctrine and you're going to have new nuances of truth. That's why there has to be